o'clock in the morning again. Tomorrow's high, 43. Right now, sunny, 28 in Racine, 27 in Kenosha. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And on today's morning show, I am honored indeed to be speaking with author Emily St. John Mandel about her superb novel called Station 11. As we have already talked about on the morning show, this book has been chosen for this year's Big Read event here in southeastern Wisconsin, under the auspices this year of the University of Wisconsin Parkside Library. And Emily St. John Mandel is actually Canadian-born, the author of three previous novels before Station 11, Last Night in Montreal, The Singer's Gun, and The Lola Quartet. And this particular novel, Station 11, has attracted a tremendous amount of attention since its initial publication, which I believe was in 2014. Do I remember that correctly?
You do, yeah. That was the fall of 2014. And thank you so much for having me on your show this morning.
I'm honored to be speaking with you. We should mention that Station 11 is now available in paperback from Vintage Books, a division of Penguin Random House. What we have not yet said is that this particular novel is a dystopian novel. It imagines a world decimated, utterly decimated, by a flu pandemic, which wipes out the vast majority of humankind. And it is a novel that imagines how survivors of such a catastrophe might try to survive, what survival would feel like, and the kind of things that would make, in a sense, survival worth it. What kinds of things make life worth living? Why do we want to take that next breath? What is it that is most precious in life? And there are a number of ways in which the picture painted of such an awful scenario is actually also a very inspiring and enlightening one. So again, I loved the book on so many levels, and I'm so glad to be speaking with you about it. I noticed in an interview that was, I think you did with NPR, or maybe it was in another conversation someplace, but you made a special point of saying that you really don't want this to be called a science fiction novel, even though sometimes people might carelessly group it with works that are a little more science fiction in nature. Just say a word about why this work is not science fiction and why you think that distinction is an important one to remember.
Something quite subjective and arbitrary about the way we think of literary genre. And so for me, it's actually not so much that I don't want it to be thought of as science fiction. It's more that I don't want it to be thought of as just science fiction. You know, I think that we all have these sort of images of what genres look like. And when you say science fiction, I think a lot of us jump to this image of, you know, Martians, stun guns, space stations. In fairness, there is a space station in Station 11, but it's in a comic book. So an idea that I came across about literary genre a few years ago that I really liked, it was a piece by Joshua Rothman on the New Yorker's website. And he made a point that I think should be obvious, but somehow sometimes isn't, which is that, of course, a book can be more than one genre. So I have no objection to it being thought of as science fiction, but it is also literary fiction in the sense that I'm very interested in things like character development, relationships between characters, larger questions about, I would go so far as to say, about what it means to be human. So it's it is a book that's set partly in the future. You know, as you mentioned, about 40% of it is set in this post-pandemic, post-apocalyptic future. But a lot of it is also set in the present day. So I suppose, to my way of thinking, science fiction doesn't quite capture the totality of that as a label.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think in the interview I read, you made the point that nowhere in this book do we find any kind of futuristic technology at all.
Right.
And if anything, we're in a world, we are in a scenario in which almost all modern technology that we are acquainted with today has been, in a sense, wiped away, torn from people's grasp. And that right there in and of itself makes this something, let's say, more than the typical science fiction that most of us are acquainted with.
An interesting side effect of that, of writing this post-pandemic book, post-apocalyptic book, where all of the technology we take for granted has fallen away, is that all of a sudden our current world becomes the world that starts to seem a little bit science fictional. You know, a debate that characters have in this novel is whether it makes sense to tell children who were born after the collapse of civilization, whether it makes sense to tell them about our current world we live in now, this extraordinary place with the electrical grid, the high-speed trains, the airplanes, the telephones. And, you know, to those kids, this world seems science fictional. the technology seems a little bit abstract. So it's kind of fascinating to think about our technology in that way, as something that would seem really quite extraordinary and fictional to people who hadn't experienced it.
Is this the first that you have written a dystopian work, or are any of your previous novels also part of this sort of world?
No, this is the first one. The previous novels were, they were all set in pretty much the present day. And if anything, they had more of a crime fiction element to them. I guess for me, the project I've always been engaged in as a writer is I want to write literary fiction, which is a little bit slippery to define, but let's say fiction with an emphasis on prose style and on character development. But I have also always wanted to write fiction with the strongest possible narrative drive. So I really want my books to have a plot, in other words. I'm trying to write page turners. And, you know, it's interesting. That focus can kind of push a person in the direction of genre. So with my first three books, I thought of them as literary fiction, but they are also crime fiction in some ways. There is a criminal element to the plot.
I loved this book, and I am not a huge fan of fiction in general, or what I should really say is I don't read nearly as much fiction as I read nonfiction. I read an enormous amount of nonfiction for the purposes of this program, for instance. And so when I am caught up in fiction, to the extent that I was with Station 11, I always tell the author, you've really accomplished something, because before we dig into a few specifics of this novel and the story that you have outlined here, I want to actually, ahead of that, talk about a device that you use, which I think is one of the trickiest things to use well in fiction. And that is that you have constructed this novel in a way in which we are pivoting between several different time frames and several different locales. And also without the use of headings that spell out for us that, okay, now it's 15 years ago, and now
right.
It's now we're back to the present, and now we're 10 years in the future. You know, you kind of leave that to us to sort out. I guess I'm curious, first of all, in general, why you wanted to construct the novel in this way, and again, are your previous novels constructed similarly? And what kind of challenge is it to do that in a way that doesn't sort of leave the reader hopelessly confused? I mean, you've achieved a remarkable cohesion, and I'm at a loss to understand how such a thing is possible.
Well, thank you. the way such a thing is possible is you just revise your book 100 times and you know, refine as you go. Yeah, I've employed a non-linear structure with, you know, lots of jumping around between points of view in all four of my novels. And I think it's safe to say that I've pushed that structure as far as I'd ever taken it with Station 11. I think Station 11 is much more complex, structurally speaking, than my first novel. To be honest with you, it's just a really fun way to write a book. There's a feeling of putting together a giant jigsaw puzzle. You know, you have all these pieces and trying to imagine the way those might fit together to create the kind of atmosphere or the kind of tension and suspense that you're looking for. So there's real pleasure in that. It's kind of a fun way to construct a story. It's also, if I'm being honest here, the only way I know how to write a novel. I've used that structure 4 times, and I'm not sure that I know how to write a linear novel. I just, it seems like it would be easier, but I've never tried it. It's a challenge I'd like to take on at some point. It seemed to me with Station 11 that jumping back and forth in time between the present day and this post-apocalyptic future, that might be kind of an elegant way to highlight the differences between those two worlds, and in so doing, perhaps to amplify them a little bit. So you could have a character in a post-apocalyptic landscape talking about, oh, wasn't it incredible when we used to have cell phones? Or you could just drop in a chapter where somebody's on a cell phone 50 years earlier. And, you know, maybe that's a more elegant way to highlight that difference. So that was part of my thinking with this book. Hmm. And in terms of keeping it all reasonably readable, not having the reader be too confused, that's something I really work hard at. You know, as you mentioned, I don't have those headings. I find those kind of clunky. On the other hand, you'll notice that a lot of chapters will begin with a sentence like 20 years after the end of air travel or 3 weeks before the end of the world.
You know? Oh, right.
So I try to create these little markers so that at the beginning of chapters when I'm jumping around in time, just to orient the reader in time and space. As a reader, I really enjoy reading nonlinear fiction, but I find it quite irritating when I can't tell for 5 pages where we are, you know, and then you finally get some clue, oh, we're in the future. Then I'll find myself flipping back and rereading, you know, the pages I just read in light of that new information. So I'm trying to avoid that. You know, you don't want to be too obnoxious with your nonlinearity.
Or too clever,
or
too opaque.
Right.
Right. Well, yeah. Well, again, as someone who doesn't read a whole lot of fiction and who, generally speaking, prefers his fiction to be fairly simple and straightforward, I want to really compliment you because I loved this novel and even its complexity and even this particular device. And I think you are absolutely right in constructing it in this way. We really get an even more vivid sense of how the world has been utterly transformed, or as said in the book at one point, time has been reset by catastrophe. I mean, on so many levels, everything is different. I also read in a previous interview that you very deliberately set most of this novel in a period of maybe 15 and even 20 years after the onset of this disastrous flu pandemic, which wipes out most of humanity very, very quickly. And it sounds like you felt that this period of time, again, it's not where we are exclusively in the novel, but mostly versus in the immediate aftermath of the catastrophe. We see some of that, but not a lot of that. Explain why this felt like a richer possibility for you.
Sure, absolutely. I've read a lot of post-apocalyptic fiction and seen a few post-apocalyptic films, and it seems to me that those are usually horror stories, sort of in the guise of science fiction. So they're so often set in that territory of mayhem and chaos and horror, immediately following a complete societal breakdown. And I just felt like that ground has been so well covered by so many other writers at this point, you know, to the extent that if I tell someone, oh, I wrote a post-apocalyptic novel, they're like, well, you know, I read The Road by Cormac McCarthy. I don't think I really need to read more cannibalism and, you know, catastrophe and horror. That ground had been so well covered by other writers. And for me, as I was thinking about this, It's not that I don't think there would be an absolutely horrific period if society were to suddenly collapse. I think there absolutely would be. But it's just not plausible to me that that would last forever, at least not everywhere on Earth, because mayhem is not really a particularly sustainable way of life over decades and generations. And it was just much more interesting to me to think about what comes next. What's the new world and the new culture that begins to emerge 15 and 20 years after? Because I think something would begin to emerge. You know, I think that by that time, we would have kind of gotten it together, so to speak. We would have perhaps solved the immediate problems of shelter and finding enough food. And what I loved the idea that there might, again, by that point, be some appetite for culture. You know, much of the novel, of course, centers around this traveling Shakespearean theater company and orchestra in this post-apocalyptic landscape. And I found myself thinking that that landscape, by that point, it might not be really very different from, let's say, Elizabethan England, where, you know, Shakespeare and his players would set out on the road, traveling from town to town, bringing theater and culture and stories to these small communities of very hardworking people. So, it was just a more interesting time frame for me than writing another horror novel. Mm-hmm.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Emily St. John Mandel, and talking about her best-selling novel called Station 11. This book has been chosen for this year's Big Read Project here in southeastern Wisconsin under the auspices of the University of Wisconsin Parkside Library. And as a matter of fact, Emily St. John Mandel is going to be coming to speak at Parkside on the evening of February 15th. And it's an opportunity to meet the author and to ask her questions about this endlessly fascinating novel. As you said, this novel, if it centers anywhere, it centers on this traveling group of actors and musicians who collectively are known as the Symphony. At one point, you say, this collection of petty jealousies, neuroses, undiagnosed PTSD cases, and simmering resentments live together, travel together, rehearse together, perform together 365 days of the year. Permanent company, permanent tour. But what made it bearable were the friendships, of course, the camaraderie, and the music, and the Shakespeare, the moments of transcendent beauty and joy, when it didn't matter who'd used the last of the rosin on their bow or who anyone had slept with. I really loved that description, and there's other vivid descriptions as well of what such a group might sort of feel like, how such a group might function, how they might operate in this utterly barren wasteland in which a few human beings are struggling to survive. Tell us more about what you thought about in creating this notion of a traveling group of musicians and actors against this post-apocalyptic backdrop. And what did you think about most in terms of making this feel like an authentic possibility? Actually quite plausible versus just the fanciful creation of a fiction writer?
Right. It's a good question. In terms of making it feel real, I was just thinking about group dynamics, which has been an interest of mine in my writing, I found. You know, you as a writer, you don't necessarily set out to follow any particular theme from one book or the next, but then you can look back over your work at some point and realize, oh, I've written about music and groups and, you know, travel over four books by accident. I've always been fascinated by group dynamics, just their being part of any group of people. And, you know, I look back to my days as a dancer. That was my first career. And I was part of a modern dance company for teenagers, basically, when I was growing up, and then performing with a group of people at the conservatory that I went to and performing with dancers professionally after that. Groups of people are so endlessly maddening and complex and fascinating and interesting to write about. And, you know, it's the same dynamic you'll get even in an office. Your colleagues who you both love and hate, and, you know, they drive you crazy, but there's such camaraderie and you really care about these people. So I feel like human nature would not change that much. I don't think it does change that much following a catastrophe, and particularly 15 or 20 years after. So that was my starting point for thinking about what it would be like to be a member of the Traveling Symphony. It's like, well, you know, you'd be in a group, and it would just be kind of a challenging and different world that you'd be moving through. And then in terms of plausibility, or in terms of, let me actually take a slightly different angle. There's a sort of, I guess, thesis statement, you could say, for the existence of the group, and that comes from Star Trek, of all places. So when I was about 19 or 20 years old, I remember watching an episode of Star Trek Voyager, and you just can't predict what random thing you hear on television will stay with you for the rest of your life. But there was a character in that episode, Seven of Nine, who said, "Survival is insufficient." And that struck me as the most elegant expression of something that I believe to be true, which is that, of course, survival is never enough for us. And that's why we have things like books and radio. You know, it's why we have things like sports. We're never satisfied with just the basics of food, water, and shelter. We always want something more than that. And that something more, you could call that civilization. It's a something more that maybe reminds us of who we are, you know, that we're human, that we're civilized. Maybe even in pretty catastrophic situations. And, you know, you see that here on Earth. You don't have to look to post-apocalyptic fiction. As a species, we'll do things like play musical instruments in refugee camps or put on plays in war zones. And, you know, so it seemed to me, as I was thinking about the ways that human nature probably wouldn't change that much, that we probably still would have that appetite for that something more. And I really liked the idea that maybe that could be a theater company and a group of musicians.
One of the things that I think you are so right, one of the ways in which I was reminded of this was, for the purposes of this program, reading a book of the history of sports photography. And in this book was a photograph from, I think, 1863 of a baseball team somewhere in the United States. And of course, 1863, the Civil War was raging, and it had never dawned on me that anybody anywhere in the North or the South was playing baseball during the Civil War.
That occurred to me either.
Right.
Yeah. But of course they would. Why would you stop?
Absolutely. And of course, you are, in a sense, taking that further, that even in this landscape of utter ruin, where so much has been torn away that was familiar, that there would be this hunger for certain things to spring up, and this, of course, would be one of them.
Right.
Which brings to mind the question, then, of why you chose a flu pandemic to be the disaster that, in a sense, wipes everything clean. And I suspect that part of the answer will have to do with the connection that Shakespeare has to the experience of plague.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, my reason for setting so much of the novel in a post-apocalyptic world was partly just that I wanted to write about our technology. You know, I thought it would be interesting to write about our world by contemplating its absence. So I wasn't interested in writing about disaster per se, and the book moves through that period pretty quickly. But, you know, if you're going to write a post-apocalyptic novel, you've got a logistical problem. You have to end the world somehow. You've got to get from point A to point B. So a pandemic just seemed like a horribly efficient way to do that. I was thinking, well, what's the catastrophe going to be? And it seemed to me that the two most efficient ways to end your fictional world in a novel would be either a nuclear holocaust or a pandemic, let's say. If you write a novel with a nuclear holocaust, you've automatically written a political novel, which just wasn't my interest with this particular work. And then given the speed at which geopolitics shift and change, you've also written a novel that's at dire risk of seeming quite dated quite quickly. A friend of mine was telling me about a book she read. I can't remember what it was called. It was an apocalyptic novel that I think came out in the 70s. Where there had been a nuclear war, and the combatants were Albania and Brazil, which makes absolutely zero sense in our present day. So I didn't want to write something that would become dated in that way. And so I thought, well, I'll go with a pandemic. I I went with the flu, to be honest, because it's kind of relatable. You know, we've all had the flu. We kind of know what it feels like. So it's less of a leap to imagine a flu than it is to imagine, you know, some other exotic disease that one might come up with in fiction. And then, as you mentioned, there is a parallel with Shakespeare. And the Shakespeare actually followed the flu in this book. I was thinking about what the symphony's repertoire was going to be. And I originally had them performing plays from a whole range of eras. So it was William Shakespeare. It was also 20th century playwrights, people like David Mamet. And then I also actually had them performing modern teleplays. They were performing episodes of Seinfeld and How I Met Your Mother. And I just couldn't quite make it work. It just started to seem a little bit incongruous to me that these people in this post-technological world would be really riveted by, you know, plays about the New York City real estate market, you know, or these other topics that are so much a product of the present day. So I thought, well, maybe I should restrict the repertoire to earlier works, maybe works before the age of widespread electricity, just as kind of a technological demarcation point. So I started to think more about what that repertoire was going to be. And the more I read about Shakespeare's life and the world he lived in, the more I began to see those parallels that you just alluded to. One of them was just that in his time, theater was so often a matter of these small traveling companies setting out on the road. But then the other, of course, was that Elizabethan England was ravaged by repeated episodes of the bubonic plague. It just swept across the country again and again and again. And those two things were actually related. When the plague came through London, theaters would close because it was just too dangerous to have all of those people gathered together in proximity. And then the players would take off on the road for a while and go from town to town. So it seemed to me there were some interesting parallels there. And I kind of liked the idea of developing those parallels, of thinking about a world in which a small company of players might again set out, where the modern world hadn't come and gone.
Right. And it is a group that is motivated by a kind of idealism, that they are sharing something important, someone at a glance might think, what could be more irrelevant in such a world than a Shakespeare play or a mm-hmm. Beethoven symphony? And that, of course, is not the way this group feels. They feel fiercely the opposite. And on the other hand, they are also carefully organized. They are armed. They have careful strategy, careful planning about where they go, the places that are safe to travel, at others where they are facing unknown dangers. Mm-hmm. I was really intrigued, and I wonder if this is sort of a Star Trek thing peeking its way through, that at one point mention is made of the fact that the group has a very strict policy of non-intervention in the various communities that it visits. And this is maybe a good moment to describe kind of the landscape that we are a part of, in which there are no longer states and nations, and the way life is now organized, and what this non-intervention policy of this group is really all about.
Sure, absolutely. It's funny, I hadn't consciously thought of that as being a Star Trek thing, but of course that is, you know, the first principle. it's an extremely local world. And that was something I kept finding myself coming back to as I thought about the way the world would change if telecommunication systems go down, if there's no longer an internet. Your world would become so small. You know, you'd have no idea what's happening on the other side of the country, let alone across an ocean.
You wouldn't know what's going on the other side of your own city.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I live in Brooklyn. Manhattan would be, you know, an undiscovered country. So I was imagining a world where there frankly aren't very many people. The people that do that are still there, they live in very, you know, kind of small communities. And I think each community would inevitably be self-governing. So every community has a different set of laws and rules. And, of course, in a situation like that, they're pretty vulnerable to strongmen, warlords, cult leaders, you know, the kind of people who can appear in a power vacuum. So I was imagining a world where, you know, some communities would probably have it together, so to speak. you know, some kind of elected system of representation. Other communities, not so much. I can imagine things getting a little weird. So what I was imagining is that the Symphony couldn't really afford to get too embroiled in local politics. You know, if you go into a town where it seems like things have really gone south and, you know, there seems to be a lot of violence and a cult leader, say, running the show, then I would think the Symphony would just want to move on, go to a different town and not risk themselves by getting too caught up in it.
In other words, they prized their own neutrality, and that was really key to their own survival, in a sense.
Exactly, yeah.
For those of you just joining us, I'm speaking with Emily St. John Mandel, talking about her best-selling novel, Station 11, which has been chosen as the big read book for this year. Big Read is under the auspices this year of the UW Parkside Library. And Emily St. John Mandel will be speaking at Parkside on Thursday night, February 15th. It will be an opportunity for people to meet her and learn more about this extraordinary novel from the talented writer who created it. One of the things that I appreciate so much about this novel, and I've seen this mentioned in a couple of different laudatory reviews, and in a sense, I guess this has also been mentioned in the one and only negative review I read, which is...
Well, there's more than one.
But it's kind of interesting. It's just only occurring to me now that what this particular reviewer didn't care for in your novel is what these other reviewers loved about your novel. And that is, in a sense, its understatedness. Mm-hmm. That is that there is much that you leave to our imagination, particularly about the unraveling of society as this pandemic sweeps through and just kills millions upon millions upon millions of people. Other novels or films or television series will show us all of that in very graphic, detailed fashion. And it is not that you ignore that, but you give us glimpses of it, which in a sense prime our imaginations to imagine the rest of it, which is so incredibly effective. I mean, I like that. I think that is an absolutely brilliant choice. Give our listeners a sense of what I'm talking about in terms of some of these glimpses of that horror and mayhem that you mentioned earlier, that you did not want to predominate the novel, and yet we have to have some presence of it, or this story does not make sense nor take hold.
Sure, absolutely. So there's a section of the novel in the post-apocalyptic part of it that takes place in an airport. And, you know, I read the most astonishing statistic once, which is that at any given moment, about 500,000 people are up in the sky in airplanes. So if there were to be some kind of a sudden disaster, then, you know, a lot of people would be stranded in the air, and those planes would be diverted to airports, and they'd be there at the airport trying to figure out what to do. So I have a situation like that in the novel, where people have descended into this airport in Michigan, everybody just kind of milling around, waiting for information. A plane lands, and then instead of approaching the airport, it goes to the furthest possible point in the tarmac, and nobody ever comes out. And that's about all you get about that plane in the novel. There's really not much more than that. And, you know, what I was imagining, of course, is that the flu breaks out on board, and they're forced to make a horrific choice. Well, do we go into this terminal full of people and expose all of them to this disease, or do we self-quarantine? And, you know, none of us make it. So it's so horrible to contemplate that even I don't really want to think about it. But the way I handle the plane in the novel goes back to a larger philosophy I have, which you've alluded to, which is just about my approach to violence and horror. And I don't mean to suggest there's only one way to approach it. You know, I've read books that describe violence in shocking detail, and it somehow works. I'm thinking in particular about a great novel called Preparation for the Next Life by Atticus Lish. It came out around the same time as Station 11. It's just an incredible novel. It's horrifically violent, but it somehow doesn't feel gratuitous. So, you know, that is one approach. Another approach, which I've tended toward, is this idea that probably anything that you, as the reader, can imagine is at least as creepy and horrible as anything I could write. So, you know, I think that sometimes it isn't necessary to show the blood spatters, so to speak. I think that sometimes just giving the barest sketch of what happened can be enough, and then the reader can fill in the rest.
Absolutely, especially with everything else that's been written or depicted on screen. If you don't mind, I want to read just a portion of the novel which talks about this airplane.
Sure.
That is sitting on the edge of the tarmac at this airport where some of these survivors have been gathered and built their own community. So, and this older gentleman by the name of Clark, one of the important characters in your novel, is thinking to himself, the maintenance of sanity required some recalibrations having to do with memory and sight. There were things Clark trained himself not to think about. Everyone he'd ever known outside the airport, for instance. And here at the airport, Air Gradia 452, silent in the distance near the perimeter fence, by unspoken agreement, never discussed. Clark tried not to look at it, and sometimes almost managed to convince himself that it was empty, like all the other planes out there. Don't think of that unspeakable decision to keep the jet sealed rather than expose a packed airport to the fatal contagion. Don't think about what enforcing that decision may have required. Don't think about those last few hours on board. And of course, what you are brilliantly doing there, even as you talk about Clark not thinking about that, is that you get us thinking about that.
Right.
You get us
imagining
what that would be like. You mm-hmm. leave it to us, and what could be a richer experience for a reader than to have one's imagination carried away, even if it is to something as terrible as that. I think also of the character in your novel, what's his name, Javin or Javin?
Oh, yeah, Javin.
Javin, who at one point, he receives word from a friend of his who's a doctor from this besieged hospital, and that's why he knows before a lot of other people know that this flu pandemic is going to be truly catastrophic, and that's what allows him to frantically get some provisions from the local store, and then he's able to take all these shopping carts to the apartment of his brother Frank, who is wheelchair bound. And it's really, in a sense, through his eyes that we get a sense of how everything falls apart. But of course, he doesn't even know the scope of everything, and much of what he knows are from these what he glimpses through the blinds of the windows, and what he sees on television, which of course becomes less and less helpful till eventually there's no more newscasts at all.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was especially telling, that without being terribly specific, just in the way news accounts, newscasts, in a sense, deteriorate through the course of this fast-moving disaster,
mm-hmm.
that gives us, in a sense, an idea of how rapidly and completely things are falling apart.
Right, and it goes back to something I hadn't really thought about very much before I started, you know, really thinking about this for the book, which is just how human everything is. You know, we, there's something I get into a little bit in the book, too, but we think of the modern world as being kind of impersonal. But, and it's easy to forget just how much human labor goes into literally every aspect of our lives. You know, from the person who delivered the gas to the gas station so you could fill up your car, for example. Or, you know, the newscaster and the cameraman showing up to work that day. You know, so, yeah, I was thinking about how probably at first newscasters would show up to work. You know, they're doing their jobs. It's an incredibly horrific and exciting moment. And then at a certain point, you would just want to be with your family. You know, you maybe wouldn't go to work. And, yeah, the news, the television news might stop at that point. So, yeah, it was kind of chilling to imagine, to be honest.
Right. You describe a scenario in which, after a while, we don't see the newscasters anymore. We just see other people who work at the station, unaccustomed to being on camera,
right,
getting in front of that camera and trying to keep the news going as long as they can. And one by one, these various channels would simply wink off the air. And I think one of the things you do especially well is that you paint this picture for us of a world in which there is almost no information at all. And you think about how utterly different that is from the world in which we live right now, in which we are deluged with information all the time. And anything you want to know about nearly anything is a couple of mouse clicks away. Yeah. And I don't think most of us can even imagine what it would be like to have all of that taken away nearly in an instant.
It's kind of disturbing. I mean, I love the internet, to be clear, and I'm very fond of my smartphone, but it's kind of interesting, isn't it, the way we've sort of outsourced knowledge to these devices. I mean, do you remember when you used to know, 10 phone numbers in your head? Now we don't even know our friends' phone numbers anymore. We just pull them off the contacts list. Something as small as that to something as large as really kind of life skills. How do you improvise a water filter, for example, or install a solar panel? These things that you might need, which you can no longer just look up. So I was thinking about that. And then also, of course, the news. We do take it for granted at this point that you could read the daily news from China or Brazil, as you say, a couple of mouse clicks. And it's kind of fascinating and unsettling to imagine that vacuum.
Mm, absolutely.
Really having no information.
Right. And, of course, in that vacuum are other disturbing things, too. At one point, the character of Javin in looking out the blinds of his brother's apartment sees fires in a distance. And
right.
This is several days into the pandemic, and he realizes now that he's never imagined fires in a city without firefighters. And just
right.
In those few words, we realize here is one more facet of this disaster that would never dawn on most of us, that would be one more awful aspect of this reality.
Yeah, you take it for granted that you can call 911 and somebody will show up.
And no medications, no more gasoline, and eventually, of course, no more electricity, which becomes a predominant theme. We should say that although we spend a great deal of time in the wake of this pandemic, there are also all of these moments before in which we are with some of these main characters before this disaster unfolds. And I think, as you said, that's a beautiful way to contrast these two utterly different worlds. I mean, it's the same world and yet two completely different worlds. One of the things that was the most sort of pleasant surprise, seems funny to use the word pleasant in talking about such things, is that I think you do a marvelous job of handling the storyline that involves someone who comes to be known as the prophet, who is, in a sense, the leader of one of these small cults that has sprung up. When I read that on the back of the back cover, before I'd even begun to read the novel at all, I to be perfectly honest, I kind of thought, oh boy, because that's yeah, right, exactly. And yet, I think you've handled that in such a way that it feels entirely plausible that such a thing would occur. What did you consider in trying to fashion this phenomenon of religious cults, in a sense, springing up in the wake of this catastrophe? And what was most important to you in making that feel real and also, in a sense, new compared to how we've seen that kind of thing treated before?
Well, I appreciate that it felt that way to you. It's a little bit tricky because on the one hand, there's a criticism that I've gotten of the book is, why do all post-apocalyptic books have an insane prophet? Hasn't this been done to death? The counterpoint to that, it's kind of like saying, why do all post-apocalyptic books have no electrical grid or no healthcare system? Well, because that's kind of just what would happen, I think. What I was thinking about with the prophet was power vacuums. In a situation where you have no central government, no authority, so to speak, something arises to fill that vacuum. And we see that in relatively lawless places in the present world. You know, think about the borderlands of Pakistan and Afghanistan. In a place like that, where things are difficult, where there isn't much of a central authority, somebody rises to fill that vacuum. So you see warlords a lot. And first, I don't know why this is, but the United States does seem to have a certain tendency towards some pretty wild religious cults. So when I was writing The Prophet, I was thinking, well, I think a prophet would inevitably arise in this power vacuum. I think that's something that people might find themselves susceptible to, particularly if you're thinking about a somewhat vulnerable population. You know, these are people who've been through the most incredible trauma. And I think that under those circumstances, some people might find themselves susceptible to someone who claims to have all the answers. I think that generally speaking, we're kind of terrified of chaos. And for some people, it might be comforting to hear this idea, you know, your family died in this horrible pandemic, but that wasn't some terrifyingly random accident. That was something that happened for a reason. It was part of a plan, and I know the plan, and if you follow me, I'll reveal that to you. So I think some people might be vulnerable to that in this kind of circumstance. I modeled The Prophet off of David Koresh of the Branch Davidians in Texas, who, in my understanding, was an extremely charming, intelligent person with kind of an extraordinary ability to flip through the Book of Revelations and cherry-pick whatever verse justified his insane idea that week. You know, so, yeah, so I was thinking of the prophet as being someone like that, a very charismatic, ruthless person.
Right.
Arisen in this power vacuum.
Right. And it's interesting to think about how in certain places a community might spring up around such a figure. And in other communities, the community would look very, very different. And in the case of, for instance, the community that has sprung up at this airport, people from various cultures, ethnic backgrounds, and so on, it is a very different kind of community, and they find connection with one another in their sorrow. At one point, you have the character of Clark again, thinking about what he has lost, saying he lost his oldest friend, but if the television news was accurate, then in all probability, everyone here with him in the airport had lost someone too. All at once, he felt an aching tenderness for his fellow refugees, these 100 or so strangers here at the airport. That's a really beautiful ray of hope in all of this, that one of the things that might keep people connected would be that sense of shared sorrow, shared loss.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Yeah.
The book again is Station 11. It has been chosen for the Big Read. It must be thrilling for you to have programs like Big Read selecting this book and giving it, in a sense, a extended life beyond the great success that it initially achieved.
Incredible. I'll never get used to it.
What's that?
I'll never get used to it. It's incredible.
Well, it is worthy of all of the attention and acclaim that it has received. Station 11, a paperback from Vintage Books. And we want to remind you that Emily St. John Mandel comes to the University of Wisconsin Parkside on Thursday, February 15th. And it is an opportunity to meet her and, in a sense, thank her personally for bringing this great work to the world. Emily St. John Mandel, I was honored to speak with you. Thank you so much, and congratulations on your great success with this marvelous novel.
Thank you so much. It was such a pleasure.
A reminder once again that Emily St. John Mandel's visit to the University of Wisconsin Parkside is tomorrow evening, and more information is available at their website, uwp.edu. Tomorrow on the morning show, it's the monthly visit of Brian Albrecht, the president of Gateway Technical College. And on Friday, you'll hear my interview with F. Diane Barth, whose book is called I Know How You Feel, The Joy and Heartbreak of Friendship in Women's Lives. The morning show airs every weekday morning between